Greetings and reticulated jubilations, my Zarconic listeners, and welcome to this January 2020 Science News Update. I'm your host for this New Year's celebration of ineptitude, Jim Campanella. Happy New Year! Let's start the year outright with two idiot scientist stories. The first is an update on that reviled crazy cloner, Jianqiu He of China. What has happened to this great, pathetic sap since we last discussed his home imprisonment several months ago? Well, nothing good, as you probably may have guessed. So, 13 months after touching off an international firestorm with his research that led to the birth of three germline-edited babies, Dr. He has been sentenced by Chinese authorities to 3 years in prison and a fine of 3 million yuan, which is about $430,000. That, by the way, is a ton of money for any academic researcher, whether they are in the West or in China. China reports that the Nanshan District People's Court of Shenzhen City, Guangdong Province, has convicted He and two colleagues, Sang Ren Li and Qin Jinzu, of illegal medical practice. All three are reported to have pleaded guilty during their trial, which was not conducted publicly, quote, due to the personal privacy of the persons involved, unquote. Sang and Qin were sentenced to jail terms of 2 years and 18 months, with a 2-year reprieve, respectively. Sang was fined about $143,000 and Qin about $72,000. And they were both also barred from conducting any future research on assisted reproductive technology, which would seem to preclude any attempts to return to the field of germline editing. The famous DNA pioneer Dr. J. Craig Venter tweeted the following, quote, I applaud the government of China for applying a prison term of 3 years for the scientist who did reckless human experimentation on genome editing of human embryos, unquote. Public prosecutors alleged that the defendants knowingly violated the country's regulations and ethical principles by conducting gene editing in assisted reproductive medicine when they were not qualified to work as medical doctors. The China news agency reported, quote, The prosecutors presented substantial evidence to prove He's team fabricated an ethical review certificate and recruited 8 volunteer couples with men who tested positive for HIV, intending to produce HIV-immune babies. They implanted genetically engineered embryos into the women's bodies and impregnated 2 of them who gave birth to 3 babies. 2 of the babies, Lulu and Nana, were twin girls born in October 2018, and both carried mutations at the CCR5 gene that codes for a known HIV receptor. The existence of a third baby, which was due to be born in May 2019, appears to have been confirmed by the sentencing report. The District People's Court declared in its verdict that the acts of He and his colleagues were carried out, quote, in pursuit of personal fame and gain, unquote, and have seriously, quote-unquote, disrupted medical order. There was collateral damage as well. Basically, anybody who worked with He in even a vague way was, well, cursed by that association. The Chinese news agency says that, quote, the Health Administrative Department has included all the persons involved in this case into a black list of human reproductive technology violations and barred them from engaging in human-assisted reproductive technology services for life, unquote. Dr. He just continues to make the lives of those around him better. Some quote-unquote progressives have suggested that we should cut He a break, and that he really didn't do anything wrong. Well, what they're forgetting is that it wasn't just a question of morality here or ethics. It went beyond that. He broke the law. Writer Tristan Free of the journal Biotechniques elegantly wraps up this story with a damning conclusion about our good Dr. He. Quote, Dr. He conducted an experiment that had no ethical review board approval, was poorly thought out, could well prove to induce negative effects in the resulting children, and he deceived the participants and included an act of forgery. Worst of all, HIV-free children could have easily been generated without the intervention of genetic engineering. This was never anything more than one man's solo race to seize the mantle of the first man to conduct genetic engineering in humans. Unquote. Okay, so, you know what? He's an idiot, but he's not the only idiot scientist from China, apparently. Not as the second story will tell you. According to the New York Times, Saosong Sen, a graduate student at Beth Israel Medical Center in Boston, was arrested on December 10th as he was attempting to fly from Boston to Beijing with stolen biological specimens in his luggage. He planned to take the vials of cancer cells to the Sun Yat-sen Memorial Hospital in China. Prosecutors stated in court documents that the incident seems to be part of a larger effort to steal material from the lab where Tseng worked and bring it to China. Tseng's roommate, also a researcher, told FBI agents that two labmates of Tseng had already succeeded in getting specimens to China, and that Tseng was just following in their footsteps. Since they hadn't been caught, he figured he wouldn't be caught as well. Prosecutors stated in court documents, quote, Tseng's efforts appear to have been part of a coordinated crime with likely involvement by the Chinese government, unquote. The Times says that Harvard University had sponsored Tseng's visa to study in the U.S. The school has since revoked Tseng's visa, and Beth Israel, a Harvard Medical School affiliate, has fired him. Over the past year and a half, concerns of U.S.-based scientists working to benefit foreign governments, particularly China's, have escalated. A number of researchers have lost their jobs for not disclosing ties to China, and more investigations are ongoing. The U.S. government has intensified efforts to prevent intellectual property theft, and Congress has introduced a bill to devote more security resources to protecting research. I don't entirely get this, though. What did Tseng and his colleague spies think they were getting or doing? I'm wondering whether these so-called tissue samples were more complicated than what they appear on the surface, because frankly, who cares if somebody steals some cancer cells? It's not like there are not plenty of cancer cells out there. It had to be something much more valuable, but no one is talking, obviously. Whatever the case may be, in the last year, because of spying, thieving, and industrial espionage, it's become harder and harder for foreign students to get education visas in the U.S. My understanding is that the visa period has been extended, the validity period for each visa has been shortened, and the refusal rate for getting a visa in the first place has increased. Okay, let's get on to the actual first story of the night. Super Wood! Able to stop a speeding bullet with a single bound. Okay, I don't know what that meant. Maybe not. As you all know, some varieties of wood, like oak and maple, are renowned for their strength. Some rare and expensive woods are even denser and harder, like ironwood or ebony. However, Dr. Liang Binghu of the University of Maryland and his research group say that they have invented a simple and inexpensive new process that can transform any type of wood into a material stronger than steel, and even stronger than some high-tech titanium alloys. Besides becoming a super light and super strong component of buildings and vehicles, these new substances could even be used, despite my earlier silliness, to make bullet-resistant armor plating. Wood is abundant and pretty low cost, and although it has been used for thousands of years to build everything from furniture to homes and structures, untreated wood is rarely as strong as metals used in construction. Well, now Hugh and his colleagues say that they have come up with a better way to densify. Is that a word, densify? Well, anyway, to densify wood. And they reported this in the journal Nature in December. Their simple two-step process starts with boiling wood in a solution of sodium hydroxide and sodium sulfite, a chemical treatment similar to the first step in creating the wood pulp used to make paper. This partially removes lignin and hemicellulose. Those are polymers that actually help stiffen a plant's cell walls. But it largely leaves the wood's cellulose, another natural polymer, and the primary polymer of cell walls intact. The second step is almost as simple as the first. They compress the treated wood until its cell walls collapse. Then they maintain that compression as it is heated gently. The pressure and the heat encourage the formation of chemical bonds between large numbers of hydrogen ions and neighboring atoms in adjacent nanofibers of cellulose, and that greatly strengthens the material. According to the paper, the results are pretty darn impressive. Hugh says, quote, "Our compressed wood is 3 times more dense than the untreated substance. Its resistance to being ripped apart is increased more than tenfold. It is also 50 times more resistant to compression and almost 20 times more stiff. The densified wood is also substantially harder, more scratch resistant, and more impact resistant. It can be molded into almost any shape. Perhaps most importantly, the densified wood is also moisture resistant. In our lab tests, compressed samples exposed to extreme humidity for more than 5 days swelled less than 10%. And in subsequent tests, we found that a simple coat of paint eliminated that swelling entirely," unquote. A 5-layer plywood-like sandwich of densified wood stops simulated bullets fired into the material, a result Hugh and his colleagues suggest could lead to low-cost armor. You will convince anybody to wear wooden armor like they were some 16th century low-caste samurai or something. Even better, Hugh says that his super wood does not protect quite as well as a Kevlar sheet of the same thickness, but he points out that it only costs about 5% as much. I guess it's possible that research like Hugh's may someday soon make it possible to live in a house made almost completely from super wood, from floors to rafters, walls to windows. Yes, I did say windows. Apparently, Hugh came up with a process several years ago to make wood transparent, if you could believe that. And imagine in the garage there may be a car whose chassis and bumpers and windshields are composed of densified wood rather than steel and plastic and glass. I don't know. I guess it's possible. Lots of things are possible, but I just don't quite see it. Next story. From super wood to super batteries. Imagine having access to a battery that has the potential to power your phone for 5 continuous days, or enable an electric vehicle to drive more than 1,000 kilometers without needing to recharge. Dr. Madhokht Shaibani of Monash University and his colleagues are on the brink of commercializing the world's most efficient lithium-sulfur battery, which could outperform current market leaders by more than 4 times. The researchers have an approved patent filed for their manufacturing process, and prototype electrical cells have been successfully fabricated by the German R&D partner Fraunhofer Institute for Material and Beam Technology. Some of the world's largest manufacturers of lithium batteries in China and Europe have already expressed interest in upscaling production, with further testing to take place in Australia in early 2020. The study was published in Science Advances on January 4th, 2020. This was the first research in lithium-sulfur batteries to feature in this prestigious international publication. Shaibani says, quote, "Successful fabrication and implementation of lithium-sulfur batteries in cars and grids will capture a more significant part of the estimated $213 billion value chain of Australian lithium, and will revolutionize the Australian vehicle market and provide all Australians with a cleaner and more reliable energy market. Our research team has received more than $2.5 million in funding from government and international industry partners to trial this battery technology in cars and grids for this year, and we are most excited about it, unquote. What about the rest of us, huh? What about us non-Australians, guy, huh? We want some of this. Come on. Everybody wants a phone that'll last 5 days without charging. Heck, I'll go for a phone that'll last a day without needing a charge. Anyway, using the same materials in standard lithium-ion batteries, Shibani reconfigured the design of sulfur cathodes so that they could accommodate a higher stress load without a drop in the overall capacity or performance of the battery. His group was inspired by unique bridging architecture first recorded in processing detergent powders in the 1970s. The team engineered a method that created bonds between particles to accommodate stress and deliver a level of stability that hasn't been seen in any battery yet made. Shibani finishes with, quote, "This approach not only favors high performance metrics and long life cycle, but is also simple and extremely low cost to manufacture using water-based processes and can lead to significant reductions in environmentally hazardous waste," unquote. Okay, bring them on. I'm ready to try it out. Next story, coffee good, but coffee better filtered. Okay, here's the gist. Coffee can help reduce the risk of developing type 2 diabetes, but only filtered coffee, not boiled coffee. New research published in the Journal of Internal Medicine from Dr. Rickard Lundberg of Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden shows that the choice of preparation method influences the health effect of coffee. Many previous studies have shown a connection between high coffee intake and a reduced risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Well, this study now offers new insight into this connection, using a novel method to help differentiate between the effects of filtered and boiled coffee. Lundberg says, quote, "We have identified specific molecules, biomarkers in the blood of those taking part in the study, which indicate the intake of different sorts of coffee. These biomarkers are then used for analysis when calculating type 2 diabetes risk. Our results now clearly show that filtered coffee has a positive effect in terms of reducing the risk of developing type 2 diabetes, but boiled coffee does not have this effect," unquote. With the use of these biomarkers, the researchers were able to show that people who drank 2 to 3 cups of filtered coffee a day had a 60% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes than people who drank less than 1 cup of filtered coffee a day. Consumption of boiled coffee had no effect on the diabetes risk in the study. The paper said that filtered coffee is the most common method of preparation in most places, including the U.S. and Scandinavia. Boiled coffee, in this case, refers to an alternative method of preparation, sometimes used in Sweden and in other countries, in which coarse ground coffee is simply added directly to boiled water and left to brew for a few minutes. All the data used in the research came from a group of Swedish subjects and was collected in the early 1990s. According to Lundberg, many people wrongly believe that coffee has only negative effects on health, maybe because previous studies have shown that boiled coffee increases the risk of heart and vascular diseases due to the presence of diterpenes. Lundberg says, however, quote, "But it has been shown that when you filter coffee, the diterpenes are captured in the filter. As a result, you get the health benefits of the many other molecules present, such as different phenolic substances. In moderate amounts, caffeine also has positive health effects," unquote. Many other types of coffee preparation were not specifically investigated in the study, like instant, espresso, and percolator coffee. These types of coffee were not common among the Swedish study population when the data was collected. But given that espresso coffee and the recently invented K-cup coffee pods are also brewed without filters, Landberg believes the health effects could therefore be similar to boiled coffee in terms of the risk of type 2 diabetes. Coffee made in a French press is prepared in a similar way to boiled coffee, so it may also not have the positive effects of reducing type 2 diabetes risk. It is unclear whether instant coffee, the most popular type apparently in the UK, would be more similar to filtered or boiled coffee in these respects. Landberg finishes with, quote, please be aware that no conclusions can be drawn yet regarding these other preparation methods and their effects on coffee. I also stress that the health impacts of coffee do not depend solely on whether it is filtered or not. It also depends on how the coffee beans and the drink in general are managed, unquote. Next story, chewing gum, left in strange places? Oh, my 11-year-old son has the unfortunate habit of sticking his chewed-up gum on whatever surface he happens to be near when he's done with it. Usually it is hidden away so that when you place your hand under a desk or a countertop, you will encounter his lovely, thoughtful gift with your fingers. I will let you just imagine the heated response this obtains from me when I am the lucky recipient. Oh, and he inevitably says he knows nothing about the gum when accused, like every child who's ever lived. At any rate, I know that this has been a habit of kids pretty much ever since gum was invented. It's not like I never came across desks when I was in grade school that seemed to have decades of the stuff hidden underneath. Well, the next story puts my son's gum-sequestering abilities to shame. Researchers from the University of Copenhagen have succeeded in extracting a complete human genome from a 5,700-year-old piece of chewing gum made from birch pitch. According to the researchers, they succeeded in extracting a complete ancient human genome from the pitch. This is the first time that an entire ancient human genome has been extracted from anything other than human bones. The new research results were published last month in the scientific journal Nature Communications. Dr. Hans Schroeder of the University of Copenhagen, who led the research, says, quote, it is amazing to have gotten a complete human genome from anything other than bone. What is more, we also retrieved DNA from oral microbes and several important human pathogens, which makes this a very valuable source of ancient DNA, especially for time periods where we have no human remains, unquote. Based on this ancient genome, the researchers could tell that the birch pitch was chewed by a female. She was genetically more closely related to hunter-gatherers from mainland Europe than to those who lived in central Scandinavia at the time. They also found that she probably had dark skin, dark hair, and blue eyes. The birch pitch was found during archaeological excavations at Siltholm, east of Rødbyhavn in southern Denmark. The excavations are being carried out by the Museum Lolland Falster in connection with the construction of the Fehmarn Tunnel. Schroeder says, quote, Siltholm is completely unique. Almost everything is sealed in mud, which means that the preservation of organic remains is absolutely phenomenal. It is the biggest Stone Age site in Denmark, and the archaeological finds suggest that the people who occupied the site were heavily exploiting wild resources well into the Neolithic, which is the period when farming and domesticated animals were first introduced into southern Scandinavia. This is reflected in our DNA results, as we have identified traces of plant and animal DNA in the pitch, specifically hazelnuts and duck, which may have been part of the individual's diet, unquote. Well, it could have been hazelnut duck-flavored gum. I hear that was all the rage 5,700 years ago. Made by Wrigley? No? I guess not. Anyway, Schroeder finishes with, quote, we managed to extract many different bacterial and viral species that are characteristic of an oral microbiome. This information can help us understand how pathogens have evolved and spread over time, and what makes them particularly virulent in a given environment. At the same time, it may help predict how a pathogen will behave in the future and how it might be contained or eradicated. Unquote. The last story of the evening has to do with gene therapy. Gene therapy is the idea of replacing genes in humans who are mutant for those genes. There has been a long and storied history of gene therapy over the last 30 years or so. We thought in the last 10 years that we had finally pretty much figured out how to get genes into human cells with as little damage as possible to the host genome. But, well, that no longer necessarily appears to be the case. And I will be honest, I'm not really surprised. So, what's the story? In order to get DNA into a human cell, one method to transfer it in is to use a virus as a carrying vector. Adeno-associated viruses are most popular for delivering gene therapies to human patient cells. One reason that they're so popular is because researchers believe that the DNA these viruses carry rarely inserts itself into the host genome. Unfortunately, that may all now be nonsense, according to results presented last month, December 9th, at the American Society of Hematology meeting in Orlando, Florida. In 6 dogs that were treated with adeno-associated virus-based gene therapy for a blood clot disorder, hemophilia B, all of them carried the therapeutic DNA within their genomes, and in some cases, the genetic material had inserted near genes known to play a role in cell growth. Currently, hemophilia is typically treated with infusions of blood clotting factor replacement, but this requires lifelong administration to keep the disease under control, and I'm sure it's probably pretty unpleasant to have to keep going back to the doctor to get these treatments. In the last decade, several trials of gene therapies, many of which use the adeno-associated virus vector, have shown promise for providing a one-time treatment that gets to the root of the cause of human hemophilia. Hints that adeno-associated viruses carry DNA might integrated to the host genome first surfaced about 20 years ago, when studies began to show that injecting newborn mice with high doses of virus could result in transgene insertion. But the research community dismissed those concerns as relevant only to young animals and thus not a concern when it came to treating adults with gene therapy. The new dog study from Dr. Denise Sabatino of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and colleagues, calls that dismissal into question. Each of the 6 dogs whose livers were investigated by the team after the original gene therapy study ended carried multiple insertions of the therapeutic payload, that is, the gene for the factor 8 protein that the dogs were missing, or regulatory sequences that were also packed into the gene therapy. In some cases, these insertions occurred near genes known to regulate cell growth. Now, whenever you're talking about genes that control cell growth, you're essentially talking about potential oncogenes, what are called proto-oncogenes. An oncogene is essentially a growth regulatory gene that goes bad and it stops functioning correctly. And what it does is it makes a cell grow out of control. And so if you're taking pieces of DNA and sticking them near those genes that regulate cell growth, you're playing with fire. Anyway, some of those cells had higher rates of division, resulting in pockets of cells containing the same insertions. This points to those adeno-associated virus-linked genetic changes as a likely cause of the increased cell growth, though more work is needed to confirm that that actually was the case. Despite the concerning genetic changes, the dogs fared well. Their livers were healthy, and they had stable, restored levels of clotting factor 8, a result perhaps due in part to the integration of the therapeutic DNA. Still, some gene therapy researchers are concerned about the possibility of those clusters of cells developing into tumors. For those of you in PETA or dog lovers, well, you probably don't want to know that the project did end in the death of all the dogs in the study. Ironically, this had to be done to determine the health of the dogs at the end, and what exactly was going on in their livers and other organs when the study was finished. Besides being disturbing to dog owners, from a scientific standpoint, it is very problematic that the dogs were sacrificed at the end of the study. I mean, here's why. It's easy to say that the dogs were healthy at the end of the study, but they had these weird genetic insertions. And unless you wait a number of years, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you have no idea if those insertions will cause the dogs to actually get cancer. Dr. Sabatino can point out these genetic abnormalities all she wants, but our understanding of cancer is still such that we cannot draw any long-term conclusions from those abnormalities unless the dogs had lived longer. Well, that's all from me for now. Don't sacrifice your dogs before they're hatched. Keep filtering that coffee. Yes, that gum under your kitchen sink could immortalize you. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.